Right, welcome back to Sheep Farm. We've got another podcast, our weekly dive into the truth, if you like, or the lies, probably more nearer the point than that. With me tonight, as usual, is our Chris. Are you on your best behaviour tonight, Chris, or have you got a bottle of red wine?
No, I've got a bottle of Montepulciano.
You got a big straw in it, or you got a glass?
No, I'm drinking out of a bottle.
Chewing on that cork. And we've been joined with another guest, who I suppose is a mate now, Master Lee. What name do you actually like going by, Lee?
Very good question. Now, you could say the nickname of Master Lee was given to me when I was on Rise Above. Yeah. Because everybody's a DJ and MC, it was kind of fitting that I needed something other than the name Lee. Now, because of my background in martial arts, where technically I am a master in the martial arts, they coined that term for me and it kind of stuck.
I like that term. I think it's a
cool name, me personally. But yeah, anyway, yeah.
Well, if ever I want a future, either as a cult leader or either a DJ or MC, then maybe it's like, I generally don't use it. And also in, say, Japanese culture, generally don't give yourself titles. It's to other people to give it to you. Now, with regards to master, I do like the idea that everybody can master themselves.
Yeah.
So I generally use the term that it's not a master of other people. It's self-mastery.
Yeah. And
in fairness, I don't think of the term master as mastering people. I always thought of it as just being a higher spirit.
Enlightening,
enlightened.
Well, some people take it different ways. There's this kind of connotation, you know, that if you're a master, that you think you're above everybody. I take it the other way, where it's actually the opposite. You need like a level of humility to actually do the work and self master.
Which we're all trying to do, really.
Yeah,
in many different ways, many different forms. So before we go on, and Chris always has a go at me because I never mention this, and we leave it right to end and go, bugger, we haven't done it. How can people contact you if they want to get hold of you?
Okay, the easiest way to contact me is via the website. So it's innerguardians.com. On there, we've got a link. Now, if you want to join, if you want to join the dojos, then there's a page for that, and we've actually got like an application that you can fill out. But if you just want to contact me directly, then there's an email link, and that's the best way.
Right. And so before we get into what we're going to have a bit of a discussion around tonight, can you explain Inner Guardians to people that don't know what Inner Guardians is?
Okay, so in a nutshell, Inner Guardians was formed in 2019, so just before...
Just in time.
Just in time, yeah. And I actually formed it when I was in Moscow. I was out in Moscow giving a presentation and a talk. And the talk was about psychological operations and things of that nature.
That'll never happen.
And I reached a point, you could say, it was almost like an esoteric crisis, like a midlife crisis, but from an esoteric perspective, where I knew something was coming, but I didn't know exactly what. There was this kind of veil that I couldn't get beyond, but I knew something was coming. I'd been informed that things were coming, but I wasn't 100% sure. But I knew it would involve like a psychological and emotional and physical operation. So you can say Inner Guardians is a lifetime of work. I've spent, you're looking at nearly 40 years of studying the esoteric and occult knowledge. So it was all of that put together with a little bit of futurism and things like and things of that nature. So you could say I put it all together. And for those who don't know, I work as a professional instructor for personal protection, self-defense. Works and strategies for the non-physical. So it's like the inner functions. So it's protection from external influences or nefarious external influences. And so it's not just about protecting the physicalities of your existence, but it's more to do with the inner functions.
Right. We seem to be breaking up a little bit at my end here. I don't know if anybody's capturing that at your end. If it carries on, we might turn cameras off and then might use a little bit less juice.
Sure.
So you I mean, I've been on your Wednesday dojos that you do on a month, monthly basis, don't you now? Can you give a bit of an insight into those and the other dojos that you hold, I think, at a weekly, aren't they?
Yeah, well, what we started off with was what's known as the Ideas Dojo. So the idea was that people could get together, like-minded people, and we could share and exchange ideas. Now, we started that on a weekly basis. I opened it up to the esoteric side. So we created other dojos. So we've got what's known as the Mind Master, which you could say it's directly linked to strengthening the mental capacity and the ability to have discernment and to not be affected by these psychological operations. Then we've got the other dojo, which is the Inner Guardians Dojo, and that's more of the esoteric stuff. So what I do is I give people the opportunity to gain esoteric and occulted knowledge. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean that you have to be really into the esoteric or the occult, but I can also give a good breakdown as to how the left-hand path or the dark occultists are using techniques and tactics. In simple terms, you can take esoteric and occulted knowledge and you can use it for the left hand or the right hand. But the techniques and tactics are pretty similar. The difference is one is used for service to self, which is the left-hand path. So that would be your dark occultist. And the other will be service to self and others. And you can extend that to the cosmos. If you want to zoom out on that.
Yeah.
A lot of the stuff is the same. It's just inverted. So we all know about inversion, the techniques of inversion. So esoteric truth is esoteric truth. They just take it and invert it and use it for their advantage.
Yeah.
And what we also teach, we teach a curriculum of all the stuff that you won't learn at mainstream school. So we teach things about the psyche, things about intuition, things about discernment, critical thinking. We use things like the trivium, quadrivium. And basically, we just sharpen up our inner functions. So we're not so easily duped or open to suggestibility from like things like hypnosis, NLP, and mesmerism. So they're the main techniques.
We saw a bit of that in 2020, didn't we?
Yeah, a lot of it. And to be honest, it's still continuing. They're just layered, and it's, you could say, psychological operations all the way down.
I would say it's always gone on. We just sort of ramped up version of it, didn't we, for 2 or 3 years. It's stayed ramped up, basically, hasn't it?
Yeah, and I mentioned this on one of the podcasts. I think it was on the Saturday Night Live that we did. I think you was there, Tom, where I looked at a load of writings and lectures and notes and things like that from World War One, and these were from the esoteric groups that were around at that time. And the comments that they were making about the situation, like the sort of geopolitical and the war situation, it was actually no different to what we're seeing now. So they were complaining that there's lots of lying, lots of deception, lots of psychological operations, lots of propaganda, all from the mainstream media. Now, obviously, it was different then. It was more about newspapers and posters and leaflets as opposed to the digital news outlets.
Yeah,
it's the same.
The big things about like when the Germans invaded, similar to what they're saying about the Russians now, when the Germans invaded Belgium and there were babies on bayonets was the big one, rallying call, where they showed a poster of a German soldier with about 5 babies on his bayonet.
Yeah.
The terrible
use your children. And then you think of the Iraq baby out of the incubator thing, don't you? So
yeah, same thing, isn't
it? Children is straight to the heartstrings, isn't it? Easiest way.
Yeah.
Everyone.
Yeah, and also like you had the financial situations. You also had the sort of coming off the back of the Industrial Revolution. So where now we're concerned about the digital revolution or the psychological revolution, they were concerned about the sort of more the physical industrial revolution where machines were becoming more prominent. I always describe it as the Industrial Revolution was the emancipation of physical slavery. Yeah, that's how it was sold. But inevitably, it went back to forms of control. Now we're going through the mental emancipation, so of mental slavery. which sounds good, but it means the opposite. It's inverted.
Yeah, it's the handover to AI.
Yeah, and so for instance, with the physical industrial revolution, people lost certain skills or a lot of skills of how to physically do things. So back then, people could probably build their own houses. They could fix their own houses. They could, you know, do all the practical day-to-day things. Mm. And then it got handed over to machinery and experts. Now we're sort of quite willingly handing over psychological and mental things over to the AI, which ultimately will lead to the reduction of mental capacity and the ability to do anything or to think about anything.
Mm. Yeah, I think the last 70 years, we handed over our health. So they had the ability, that's mental and physical. So they had, the ability then to lull us into this false sense of security that they cared to enable this AI handover.
And on a physical level is, like I'm a chef. We've seen that art form or skill or whatever dilute, even though I've got loads of foodies around, your everyday, not most people can't cook, can they?
Yeah.
They can't, never mind grow their own food, they can't feed themselves.
Well, I was going to say that one of the main things that's been under attack is the food chain and the ability to be sustainable with regards to our own food. Now, I'm of a certain age that when I was a child, I would probably consume around about 80% of the food products directly from the garden. And even things like elderflower juice, chamomile, you know, things like that, and herbs as well, that would come directly from the garden. Now, even if you look at the size of gardens in modern homes, it's kind of not enough space to grow anything. And I should imagine that a lot of children now, they couldn't even grow a tomato.
Yeah. I mean, we, as you know, we were brought up on a farm, and that type of stuff, I'm not saying it's all second nature for us, but planting something and growing something, rearing animals, it's quite a second nature thing for me, and I'm sure Chris as well. Cutting
meat up. Even that's behind us now, Fire, isn't it?
But it wouldn't take me long to trip back into that, I don't think. I mean, cutting meat up and things like that doesn't, you know, it don't concern, even if I don't want to eat meat, I could still cut it up. It's not a big major.
Well, I still do. I don't eat meat, but I still
no qualms.
I'm happy cooking.
We were burning animals out, if you like. Sorry for all you vegans. When we were... you know, 8-9 year old, we're going, it wasn't a nice time sometimes going to a slaughterhouse, but it did give you the essence of what you were eating, the spirit, which is lost now.
Especially Skippy's spirit.
Yeah, especially Skippy's spirit. But yeah.
That was my pet sheep that day that I ended up eating. Not on purpose, I didn't know, but yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, my upbringing was relatively ordinary. But I was fully aware of having grandparents and neighbours. And I remember, like, the door was never locked. And I'd quite often come home and the neighbours would be sort of sat at the dinner table sharing food with the family. And if ever my parents weren't there when I finished school, I could quite easily go next door. That was kind of... That was mentality.
Different mentality. Totally different mentality.
Totally different. Like I say, I remember we never used to lock the doors, front or the back.
No, we didn't at home. People used to come down.
Policy, wasn't it?
Yeah, people used to come down. You turn up, somebody be in the yard. They put a kettle on, you know, it'd be like that. And, you know, they'd been there 15, 20 minutes, half an hour, walking around.
In fact, they'd walk in and put the kettle on themselves.
Yeah, they'd walk in and put kettle on themselves.
It was that old boy who was always sat at the kitchen table reading the paper. I don't even think I knew his name.
Yeah. but yeah, I mean, them days are gone, sadly, whether we like it or not, for the majority of people. They're taking the human element out of everything. And I do remember as Dad saying, supermarkets are going to destroy everything. And he were right, because your conversation, you walk around the market and talking to people, that were gone. All you spoke to were the checkout woman. And now it's not even a checkout person now. It's just a digital bleep.
Yeah.
Every market town up north was packed, wasn't it? Dewsbury, Huddersfield.
I'm sure it was the same down by Ewley. Yeah,
I'm sure it was the same everywhere. You got everything there, didn't you? And it sounds like a small thing, doesn't it? But you take that away and people aren't communicating, and then they're not, I suppose, they're not plotting and planning and thinking about what's going wrong in the world. Do you know what I mean? It's like when they took the pub away at the beginning of the nonsense. Same thing.
One of the things that materialism and, I guess, scientism has been able to produce is this sense of goals being achieved. Now, with this thing about achieving goals, they've neglected the process. So I would say years gone by, we weren't so obsessed about the goals. We was more interested in the process. And what I mean by that is like community, family life.
Nurturing.
Yeah, exactly. So I was quite fortunate. My parents and grandparents, they were into growing food. Like I said, I would probably consume 80% of the garden's product. Now, and I also remember that probably around about the age of 14, 15, 16, I remember sitting in the garden and I was thinking, well, soon I've got to leave home and get a job and do all the things. And I really didn't know what I wanted to do. But I did have a real sense that I just wanted to stay in the garden and grow food. I was very much into biology. That was my number one subject. I pretty much didn't do very well in all of the other subjects because me and the mainstream education system didn't get on very well.
Strangely enough, neither did it me.
I'll put my hand up as well. In fact, I won't put my hand up, I'm just going to interrupt.
And then I later discovered through my esoteric journey and research and practice that it's linked to the essence. So that would have been my essence talking to me. Mm. So the essence is more aligned with nature and the process and natural life. So I was probably more in essence than the world wanted me to be. And like I say, as I got closer to the age of 16 and 17, where I had to, you know, sort my life out and go to college or university and things like that, I really wasn't interested.
Yeah.
I mean, it's horrible to think that you're expected to know by the time you're 15 what you want to do for the rest of your life. I'm sure it's done on purpose that you're told to find your vocation, stick with it forever, train probably for 3 or 4 years that you could probably cram into a year. Only train for one thing, and that's it. You're done. Even though at 15, if anyone knows what they're doing at 15, I'm sorry, but they're insane. Because you don't.
Yeah, I remember, I think it was about the age of 14, 15, and the town that I grew up in was very much an industrial boot and shoe town. And they used to ask me in the careers classes, whatever that was, they used to ask me what I wanted to be when I grew up. And I said I wanted to be a marine biologist. Now, they said, well, you're nowhere near the sea. You're probably in one of the most landlocked places in the country. So what do you really want to do? And I said, I want to be a marine biologist. And they said, well, no, but what do you really want to be? So I kept on repeating that. Anyway, the next day they took us to the boot and shoe factories and they lined us all up. And they said, right, you've got a choice. You can either spray the leather, you can put holes in the leather, or you can put the shoes in a box. What would you like to do as your occupation in the future?
I'll walk in them, thank you. And I'm going that way.
Wrap them around your head.
Yeah. So that gave me the gist of what was to come. So it was almost like this system had already prepared my life for me. And I guess I had a bit of it gave me a red flag. That was like a major warning that I needed to do something or be alternative. And I'm sure I'm not alone in what I'm saying. I'm sure there's lots of people that resonates.
Yeah. Well, what's your take? What do you view as materialism? Obviously, it's a difficult one to just nail and say. I view it as anything that isn't essential, but then obviously other things can sneak in and say, well, that's essential and that's essential. But that's not really materialism, is it? They're material objects, I suppose. It's more of a mindset, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I consider everything as energy. What we would consider matter is just a concentration of energy. So there's just degrees of concentration. So I see this realm as an energetic realm. The chair I'm sitting on and the table and so on and so forth, I would consider that to be concentrations of of energy into matter. Now, from the sort of scientism perspective, they would go along with what Galileo set up many, many years ago. He basically said, whatever can be measured in the physical world is science or scientific. So that meant that things like consciousness got thrown out the window because you can't measure it. Now, materialism is basically whatever can be physically measured.
There's your first reset whenever Galileo said that.
Yeah. And then they kind of, they were able to fudge around it by creating quantum physics as a type of science where they can kind of go into the more metaphysical and energetic and non-physical aspects. But science generally, they avoided anything to do with things like spirit, soul, consciousness. All of these subjects they steered away from. And I've said this many, many times on many different podcasts that it was around about 1874, that's where scientism really kicked off with the agenda of materialism. Now, my take on it is that the powers that shouldn't be, or the power possessing entities and agents of that, they like control. Now, it's far easier to control what you can see and measure because then you've got a value to them. Yeah. And if you look at the way modern society is structured, it's all about measuring, whether it's your carbon footprint, whether it's your bank account, whether it's energy in terms of smart meters. They've got this obsession of control. So they have to materialize everything. So in around about 1874, 75, there was an agenda that started, and they had to eradicate the concept or notion of spirit or anything that you can't see, touch, or measure. And they infiltrated every single aspect, especially religion. And you could say that was the main split with, say, Eastern Orthodox and Western Orthodox Christianity. So if you look at Eastern Orthodox, they're very much into the spiritual side of their religion. Whereas if you look at now the sort of Western, if I just say Christianity, because that's predominant in the West, there's not really any sense of spirit or consciousness and things of that nature. It's been heavily materialized, even from a religious perspective.
Hmm. Yeah.
We've even seen the rise of that in our lifetime, I think, of getting rid of any form of spirituality.
Yeah, and then they extended that. They had to, so to counterbalance scientism of that time, around about 1874 onwards, you had the rise of what is known as the Silver Age, which is where all of these esoteric and occult groups suddenly appeared. And that was kind of to counterbalance. And in terms of Steiner speak, that would have been the balancing of energies. So if there was an imbalance of materialism, there would suddenly have to be spiritual energy sent into this realm. And that would have given inspiration, motivation, and data to spiritual teachers of that time. So there was an uprising of that to counterbalance it. But of course, scientism and materialism had to infiltrate and hijack most of that stuff. And things like new thought or the law of attraction manifesting. So you could say that they are spiritual paths, but where does it end up? It ends up back into materialism. Because it's all about manifesting a better physical material life as opposed to a great spiritual existence.
And I remember having a conversation with you once, and it sort of, many conversations with you fry my head, but which is, in fairness, that's what it's strange, isn't it? Because when I don't meet many people that, I won't say challenge me, I mean challenge in the nicest possible sense. My way, not my way of thinking, but to go to the next place.
No, I mean, you're thinking a different way.
Yeah, I remember going, I was working with her, she was a psychologist, but she was also into a lot of other stuff. This was going into the 2000s. And I sort of, without sounding too arrogant, it might sound arrogant, I hope not, but I sort of outgrew what she was teaching me. Because I started questioning what she was doing, and then it started causing me problems with it. I weren't questioning her because I didn't think she knew what she was talking about. She obviously did, but I was questioning the next stages, and she didn't know the next stages. And yeah. I think listening to you,
sounds
they are the next stages.
No, sounds very arrogant.
It's taken me another 10 years to bump. Yeah, I know to bump into somebody like Lee that showed me what the next stages are.
Well, also going through life, you meet folk, don't you? You make you think about things and change your viewpoints on things.
Yes.
And some you don't even realize till you get older or a few years later, and you think, my God, that person actually made me take a different fork that I might have done.
Yes. And
Well, one of the definitions of the occult, and not many people realize it. Now, once again, a lot of these words, they've been hijacked and they send them into... They create a type of straw man. It becomes very misleading. So when people hear the term occult, they generally avoid it because they think it's linked to some kind of Satanism and stuff like that. When a good definition of the occult simply means alternative to the mainstream. And you can look this up. You can Google this. So when something is of the occult, then it's just alternative to the mainstream narrative or education. So you could actually say anybody that's gone against the mainstream narrative over the last few years is a type of occultist because they're looking for an alternative.
Now, I would say those three sitting in a massive occultist. Then.
Yeah.
And there's three of us. Oh, no.
Yeah, sometimes people ask me, am I an occultist? I say, yeah. And they're like, whoa.
Like, you're right. It's been hijacked.
Yeah, it's been inverted, hasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, but I, the way I generally use the word occult and esoteric or esoteric is that I go with occult in terms of the knowledge. Okay, so when I talk about hidden knowledge, then I use the occult for that. When I talk about the hidden aspects of a human, then that's where I use the term esoteric. Now, I can give you a good kind of a better definition of that. So the listeners won't be able to see this, but you can see it on the camera. I'm waving my arms. Yeah. You can see that. Yeah. But now you can't see what I'm thinking.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you have the perception to see my physicality and even my actions and possibly my intentions physically. But you can't see the mind. You can't see the emotions. You can't.
Yeah, really, in your head, you're sticking two fingers up at me.
So straight away, when we talk about the esoteric, we're talking about what you can't see. So, for instance, people hide their intent. Yeah. Now, what have the power possessing entities been doing? They pretend to do one thing when their intent is something else. So that would be the negative use of the esoteric. Now, when you have a better understanding of the inner functions of the self and others, it means that you have a greater ability not to kind of be introspective or kind of think about things too much. It actually enables you to enjoy the physical world, the physical realm, in a greater depth, because you actually experience this reality with the whole of oneself as opposed to just the physical or just the non-physical. I would say it's all about the balance of the two worlds. So in esoteric speak, we talk about the inner world, the outer world, and then there's the third world. And once again, when I say the words third world, people think about poor people. So they've taken that term. That term is actually meant to be the middle ground between the inner and outer world, the balance.
And the those people probably are the balance.
Possibly, yeah.
Yeah, because they're probably more in touch with the spiritual side than anybody.
Yeah, but that actually leads to a very interesting concept or idea. So going back to, say, 1870s, a lot of the knowledge and the spiritual teachings came from the East, where there was an abundance of spiritual life and people living on the land and in tune with nature and so on and so forth. So the knowledge of spirit came from the East and it blended with the materialistic nature of the West. Okay, so a lot of the Eastern traditions don't work for the Western mind who are stuck in materialism. So there had to be a third option. So the works of Steiner, the works of people like Gurdjieff, Ouspensky, they were able to formulate systems that would actually bridge the two worlds. And so they would say that there was a time, era, epoch where the West needed more spirituality, less materialism. Okay, now you could say that in the West, it's actually very beneficial to study the esoteric. Why? Well, because we have the kind of catalyst of materialism to actually gain friction from. Yeah. Whereas in the East, where everybody's living in tune with nature, yeah, they might live better lives, but there's probably less growth. Because ultimately, we're talking about the growth of essence. Yeah. So if somebody's born in the East with, I don't know, 10 units of essence, they'll live their life, and when they die, they've probably got 11 units of essence. Now, in the West, because of all of the things that go against essence, you could actually say that it creates really good conditions for essence to grow, as long as it's done in the right way. So you could be born with 10 units of essence, but when you die, you may have 20 units of essence. And this kind of makes sense of why things are happening the way they are. And it's not just a case of evil taking over. So the teachers like Steiner and Gurdjieff, they were very clear about this, that it's almost like we have to have this denying force. We have to have these problems in our life because it helps us to grow. There's a saying, there's nothing more useless than a billionaire's son.
So just Lee, what you're saying is basically we're lucky to be born in the West in a way, even though the East would be more spiritual because this is more of a challenge to...
Yep.
To gain essence, if you like.
Yeah.
Whereas in the East, it's kind of easier because it's not as much of a challenge because they're born with more spirituality anyway. Me and my missus travelled around Sri Lanka and what lovely, beautiful people. I mean, I said to my missus so many times, we spent 2 months there, went all the way around it, saying I'm embarrassed to be English because we're just assholes
animals
to them. They're the nicest, friendliest, you know, generous people. But then what I noticed was when you get into the city, like the main city, where, you know, it's like any other city, it changes again.
Scumbags again. Yeah.
Well, they'll rip you off, whereas nowhere else in the country I found anyone would rip you off for anything.
Yeah. The esoteric definition of what you're describing is that humans can either be essence-based or essence predominates, or they're ego-based and the ego predominates. So you could say in the West, ego rules the world. It runs the world. It predominates in all of us ordinarily. But say in the East, or more sort of, natural places, essence can predominate. And so going back to, say, Steiner and Gurdjieff, they were able to devise methods, systems that could help people in the West. So you no longer need to go running away to the Himalayas, to the mountaintop, to have a spiritual experience. You could say that the development of essence and spirit, soul, astral bodies, higher being bodies can actually take place in ordinary life, day-to-day life.
In the middle of the madness.
Yeah, and that was one of the main things that attracted me to this type of teaching. Don't get me wrong, I went down all of the paths of... sort of spiritual path, Hinduism, even Christianity, Zen. I practice a lot of Far Eastern religions, and I found that I wasn't getting the results because I'm Western, and I was always trying to do it in a Western setting, and I just wasn't getting the results. And that's pretty common for those people that in the West come across the occult and esoteric studies of the Silver Age. And going back to, you know, what is the Inner Guardians? Well, I would say it's an accumulation of this, because I realized that we don't have time. We don't have the option to go off to the Himalayas to meditate, to develop ourselves. Okay. It's going to have to be quick. Time is all we've got. So we need very much a quick fix to.
Time is the essence. There's the phrase.
Yeah, there you go. So we need ways to develop ourselves in essence to find balance, but also we need the protection. So the essence needs to be protected, and that's what the ego generally does. And there's nothing wrong with the ego as long as it's healthy. The problem is when through materialism it becomes externalized and it becomes something that predominates in us.
On a very simple level, simplistic level compared to that is, I've always thought that the literally one of our main meanings is to rid ourselves of the negative ego. You get it every day, don't you? Something happens and you think, oh, I'm really clever because I did that. And I think it's nice to have it kept in check. Yeah. I think the universe sometimes does keep it in check for you. It throws a little spanner at you and says, wake up, you're not bad.
Yeah, well, you are. I mean, there's lots of spiritual traditions that will tell you to abandon the ego, to destroy the ego, and they see the ego as the enemy. Now, the thing is, without ego, you've got no protection.
Yeah.
Now, if you walk around in essence, surrounded by narcissists and psychopaths and manipulators, you're going to have problems. So a healthy ego is actually designed to act as a buffer from the external world, the external influences. So it prevents it from actually affecting your essence.
Now, what do you say? It's like a firewall, Lee.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it's a firewall. Yeah, and it works the other way around as well. So the ego and personality actually prevents us from entering or taking our dirty boots into higher spiritual dimensions. Now, some people get upset because they can't experience the spiritual world. Well, yeah, that can be problematic, but actually it's a kind of fail-safe mechanism of the cosmos that it has to protect the higher worlds so that the lower doesn't enter the higher until it's ready. Yeah, so
rather this like is a filtration where, system.
Yeah, so this is where like the shadow work, the doing the inner work, you know, being able to look at ourselves in the mirror and realize that we are part of the problem. You know, we are the enablers, we are the codependents of evil, of Satanism, of all of the bad things that we get to see now very clearly.
And that's the whole thing about living a lie. We all really have or are lived a lie at some point, even if we're trying not to now, because we can't be authentic in this trauma-based material world that we live in. And no, but we can't be honest with the lie, can we? We can't say it. Well, we might be able to, but even we will still partly be living a lie, whether we like it or not, because sometimes you go, oh, that's wrong. So you still live in that,
yeah,
in that space, whether you like it or not. And even though you're trying to move out.
Yeah, but that's also a fact. That's part of the learning curve, isn't it?
Is there, yeah, of course it is.
That's why we're here. We're here to learn. And
yeah. A trauma know, farm.
We're not here that long, are we? You've got to ramp it up a bit. You know.
Yeah.
Well, we've all paid taxes. We've all contributed.
Don't talk to me about that.
We've all contributed towards this beast system. So yeah. We've all got our hands dirty. Yeah, in one way or another. And this is where the right use of the ego is correct. So just for the listeners who maybe, they might be a bit confused about the definitions of ego and essence and what does it really mean? Well, I'll try and do it as quickly as possible. Now, essence you could describe or define as what is essentially you. Yeah, it's what you bring into this realm. And you would have brought that essence from a past lifetime. Yeah, or series of lifetimes, or even eternal recurrence. So essence is who you truly are. That is, you could say, the authentic self. And children, up until the age of 3, essence predominates. Okay, they don't really have the levels of personality. So the personality starts to form at around about the age of 3. Now, don't hold me to that, because some may start personality at 2, some might be 4 or 5.
Yeah.
But rough figure is around about three. And I don't think it's a coincidence that it's three.
No, especially when apparently they can't remember. Children don't remember anything beyond 2 year old. Before 2 year old.
So Steiner would say that the most important aspect or time of a child's or baby's life is when it first stands up. You could say that's the first initiation into this realm, is the standing up process. And in times gone by, that was really celebrated. There was a lot of emphasis placed on the child when they first stood up for themselves, by themselves. So it was almost like the initiation into this realm. And you could say that's when, it's around about when the personality starts to kick in. Now, going back to the point of essence and ego, and some people would disagree, especially modern day psychologists, but this is, I'm explaining it from more of an esoteric perspective. So essence predominates. Then you've got external forces of the parents, usually. And it could be babysitters, it could be next door neighbors, aunts, uncles, grandparents. They'll start to tell the child what to do. Now, at some point, the essence will say to the child, well, that's, they're telling me to do something that's not authentic. They're telling me to just do something that doesn't make any sense. So they're telling me, they're trying to get me to participate in this illogical fallacy and the lie of the realm. Yeah. So the essence knows this. Why? Because the essence has already been through this process from a previous lifetime where they've experienced all of the bullshit of this realm. So you could actually say the essence is what is true. It's the pearl within that you've extracted.
Hence why children ask such simple questions that make so much sense.
From the mouth of babes, as they say.
Yeah.
And that's why they put dinosaurs and spaceships on pajamas, because they're getting them as soon as possible to...
trying to poison them.
Now it's unicorns and bloody rainbows, isn't it? Sexualizing kids before they know what's going on.
Yeah, so when the child... And we've all done this. Now, some of us would have been more conscious of this process than others, but when we are confronted with the external abnormal conditions that make no sense to our essence... But we still have to comply, because a child of the age isn't going to say, no, I'm not going to do this. I'm going to do whatever. Yeah, they have to comply. So there has to become a middle ground. Now, excuse me, to protect the essence, because the essence is not going to participate in that. You have what's known as the ego and the personality. So that starts to form and it acts as the buffer, like the middle ground of compromise between the authentic world of the essence and the inauthentic world of abnormal external conditions and commands and programming and indoctrination and miseducation. So the personality, it acts as a buffer. It kind of absorbs and it enables the child to, I guess, not go crazy, because the child has to do most of the things that are demanded from the child. And so it does it through personality, and that acts as a protection to the essence. So the objective in a child life and adult life is to protect and preserve the essence. Now, when we have these kind of moments of truth, or when we get to see a lie or a deception, that kind of gets banked into the essence. And then in our next incarnation, we will carry that through to the next incarnation. Now, if you don't protect the essence, then that can become problematic. And this is when we go into the realms of childhood trauma. And this is why the Satanists, they have this obsession with childhood trauma, because it's a way to damage and control the essence.
A trauma farm.
And then you think about going to school, you know, we send kids to school and we tell them to, they've got to do as the teacher tells them, listen to the teacher no matter what. And I'm not blaming the teachers, by the way, or even the school, but the system set up to attack the essence at that age. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or, you know, just as they're willing to listen and absorb all the information, and then they're told it's all right to cut your tits off and grow a dick.
Yeah.
Well, the other thing about essence, right? Remember what I said, that essence is what is essentially you. So if we go with reincarnation. So let's say you lived a previous life. In that life, you would have experienced equal amounts of bullshit as to this life, just in a different way, in a different time, in a different setting. Yeah. Now, the truth that you were able to extract or accumulate or keep, you carried through to this life. So you was able to bank that truth and in your essence. And it acts like as an accumulator. So in this life, and this would explain why some people are more aligned to authenticity and truth than others. Because for some, hypothetically, this time right now could be their first incarnation or second, third, fourth. But for others, it could be a hundredth. It could be the thousandth time that they've incarnated. So they have more essence. And for people that maybe they can't remember childhood, or the listeners that can't remember their childhood, even right now, I'm sure that everybody can think of a moment in their adult life where they have to be in personality, usually in the workplace, usually around family members. But sometimes you're with like-minded people that can be in essence. So you kind of drop the personality, you drop the ego, and your essence can start to predominate. And you feel safe in that way by expressing essence truth, as opposed to just going along with, what the football results or, stuff like that, yeah?
I think that's happened a lot over the last two or three years. I mean, meeting people, like we've met you, you've met us, we've met Lance and the guys, we've met lots of other people, Mark Devlin and people like that, where you don't even have to, you don't need your protection when you're chatting to people, because there's no competitiveness there. There's no... It's not the same as being in the corporate world where somebody's trying to take something off you. Everyone's looking for information, and everyone's willing to give information. And that is probably pure. There's no attack on your essence there, is there? There's no living a lie.
No, and because we're living in this kind of abnormal external conditioned world that has no place for essence, you literally have to create like sacred spaces or sacred times for the essence to appear. And it could be done alone. It's better if you can do it with others at the same time. And that would be what you would describe as an esoteric group. So it's a group of people that can get together once a week, twice a week, once a month, once a year, whatever. They get together, they can drop the ego, drop the mask, drop the false personality, and essence can finally predominate in a safe environment. No one's going to take advantage of your essence. And even listening to these podcasts, people listening, maybe if they're at home, they will have a sense that their essence is rising or starting to predominate as opposed to the ordinary personality.
And I suppose if you look at, say, going to a football match and you're going with your mates, say, that's an artificial essence, isn't it? That's sort of like subverting essence. It's not real. Everyone thinks it's real, but that is like an artificial bolt-on essence, if you like. Everyone thinks that's that important, that's who they are. They identify.
We call that identification. And without going too kind of deep into energetics, identification takes place with sex energy. So we're given sex energy from the realm, from the cosmos. And if it's not used for sex, it's used for forms of identification through the personality.
Which is what Freud was tapping into, and his nephew Bernays, that's what they used to sell things, isn't it? That's why they had a lady in the 30s smoking a cigarette suggestively, or whatever it might be. It was all done to sell that, to use that energy, that type of energy.
Yeah. So you could say like sex energy predominates. It's just a case of how we harness it or how we use it. Obviously, we're not procreating all of the time. Well, not everybody, but maybe some. So that we have an excess of energy, and the dark occult world, they fully understand the functions of this. So then they have to create alternatives. So you'll find that with every single esoteric truth, they have to create like a physical version, a physical manifestation to channel that energy. That's why when it comes to the government councils and power-possessing entities, they're quite happy to have certain things like pubs and football matches and entertainment, because it has to be channeled. Now, if it's not channeled, at some point, either people would go insane or they would actually use it to develop their essence. And they can't have that.
Yeah.
I would go with the latter, actually, Lee.
No, I think some people would go insane and other people would probably. There'd be a split somewhere, wouldn't there? Like what we're doing. I suppose that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to develop our essence, aren't we?
It can't be an accident. Now you're talking about that. That they bring out, say, a football game or a sports game. They get everyone drilled up. And I remember going back a few years. They were on about a boxing match. I don't really watch boxing, but and they got it to a point where people who don't even watch boxing were excited about this certain match, talking about it. And you've grasped the half the Western nation talking about this thing that doesn't really matter.
You're basically talking about film trailers being played over and over again, aren't you? It's the same film trailers principle, really.
But even a film release fight, which comes out, say, for instance, a new superhero film or a star, it comes out and it's out at the cinema for 2 or 3 weeks. You've got half the world going to watch it for those 2 weeks.
An energy drain.
Focusing on that same subject, whatever programming they've got in that film at that time. Yeah. Everyone focusing on it at the exact same time. I mean, what level of spellcraft is that?
Well, it's the bread and circuses, isn't it? So they have to have an outlet, and you've literally got council departments that specialize in sports and entertainment.
Yeah,
that's what they're tasked to do. They have to allow the population or the communities to have an outlet. Otherwise, like I say, they either go insane or they start to develop essence. And I think this was one of the things that backfired in 2020 with the lockdowns. Now think about it, because they denied a lot of these kind of outlets. Some people went insane and others started to look within and they started to consider and connect. And essence, when you're in isolation, when you're not in the workplace, guess what? Your essence can start to appear.
Yeah.
And I think we've all witnessed that and we've all experienced it to one degree or another. So you didn't need to go to the Himalayas to meditate. You could do it at home during lockdown. And One of the other things that I've noticed over the years, last couple of years, is something that I call the post-truth experience. So now that we've gone through the lockdowns, now that people have had to, or they've had to confront maybe some shadows or issues, their essence has now appeared. If they're not careful, now that kind of we're going back to some kind of normality, there could be some kind of not psychological problems, but a level of maybe insanity, because it's almost like you don't fit into any world anymore. And around about 2021, and I think this was on Rise Above, I said, look, whatever your dreams, aspirations, and desires were in 2019, pick them back up. Because for 2020, everybody dropped everything. I think a lot of people dropped everything. They, nobody knew what was going to happen. Nobody knew if there was going to be a future. We at that point we didn't know whether we're going to get a knock on the door and would all be
dragged out,
and executed and put in gulags. Mm. So a lot of people dropped their, you could say, even essence-based desires and aspirations. And I said in 2021, look, whatever they were, pick them back up. Now they may have changed because maybe you're aligning yourself in a different way.
I remember hearing you say that, Lee, to be fair.
Yeah, so it's important, right? Because I definitely go with what you could call spiritual science. So in the beginning of the podcast, we talked about what is matter, what is material, what is science. It's what you can measure. The spiritual aspect is what you can't measure. It's the intangible, it's the invisible. So when we talk about spiritual science, it's the two together. So you can have what's known as a spiritual bypass, which means that you drop all interest in the material world and you become kind of uber or pseudo spiritual, where it's all about energy and basically you become useless for self and for anything else. Or you can go the other way into science-based materialism. Well, when you have the two, spiritual science, it basically means that you're able to have a sense of spirituality, a sense of essence, but you still have some importance in the material world. And it's about balance. You could say, well, I often say, well, you could be spiritual, but you need to bring receipts for your spirituality. Yeah. Because anybody can sit there and,
Is it be in that world but not of it? Is that the saying there?
Yeah, yeah. And that was exactly what these spiritual science masters like Steiner and Gurdjieff, that's exactly what that was all about. They were definitely against the kind of Luciferian angle where everything's just all energy and you're heavily focused on the Galactic Federation in some kind of distant galaxy.
Yeah, yeah.
And yet the whole world is falling to pieces. Mm. And so we've say Steiner, he was very much into being a force for good in the world. So you could actually witness the physical manifestation of his spiritual world. And with Gurdjieff, he was very much into the practical applications of the spiritual world. And so, yeah,
sorry, we come to end of hour one, believe it or not. generally, we use hour two for members, so we've got 3 or 4 minutes. I want to get into the Gurdjieff and Steiner stuff in hour two,
sure.
And the moon stuff that we were talking about, the parasitical attachments as well. Yeah. So, what I would say to people listening now is that. If you want to join us and for that chat, come over to Sheep Farm members for hour two. If not, we'll see you next week. Bart.
And I'd like to say Dom's a parasitical moon-headed attachment to me.
Ah.